Welcome to Hinshaw Insurance Law Television. This program features prominent lawyers and insurance industry professionals discussing issues of interest to insurance and reinsurance professionals and practitioners. I'm Royal Oaks of ABC News and the law firm of Hinshaw & Culberson, LLP in Los Angeles, inviting you to join us for this episode of Insurance Law Television. Before we get started, a reminder that the information on Insurance Law Television is provided for general information purposes only. Nothing stated on the program constitutes legal advice or shall create an attorney-client relationship. You should consult directly with an attorney of your choosing if you wish to obtain any advice with respect to any claim, case, or matter. Any views expressed are those of the guests and are not necessarily the views of Hinshaw & Culbertson or any of its clients. And now here's your host for Insurance Law Television, the co-chair of Hinshaw & Culbertson's Global Insurance Services Practice Group, Scott Seaman.
Thank you for joining us on the premier episode of Insurance Law Television. As many of you know, several years ago, we launched Insurance Law Radio. And because so many people tuned in, we thought it would be great to take advantage of the age of Zoom and usher in a television version. Our guest on this episode of Insurance Law Television is Jeff Sistrunk. Jeff is editor at large for insurance at Law 360. He has reported on insurance law and regulation at Law 360 for the past several years. And we're going to be exploring some of the key insurance law rulings in 2020 and look at some cases to watch in 2021. And nobody has a better pulse on the cases of interest to insurers, policyholders, and reinsurers than our friend Jeff. In fact, Jeff's recent articles on the biggest insurance decisions in 2020 and insurance decisions to watch in 2021 are available on at law360.com. And many of those cases will be cases that we discuss here today. Jeff, thank you very much for joining us. As you know, you're our favorite guest and we enjoy catching up with you. And we're gonna do it again mid-year so we can keep everybody abreast on all the key decisions.
Thanks for having me.
And let's jump right in. But before we get into specific cases, let's talk about probably the biggest item in 2020 globally, which is COVID-19. And in our universe, the COVID-19 coverage cases, because the issuance of various governmental orders requiring businesses to temporarily modify or limit or close their operations led to an almost immediate avalanche of claims and lawsuits involving business interruption losses under first-party commercial property policies. And since we're dealing with trial court decisions, there's lots of different ways to keep count, and getting a precise count is hard to do. But for purposes of today, we're going to use the numbers that are reported in the Penn Law COVID Coverage Litigation Tracker. And those numbers tell us that by the end of December, almost 1,500 COVID-19 business interruption and civil authority cases, coverage cases had been filed in federal and state courts across the country. And about 475 of those cases included allegations of bad faith. And many of those cases also sought class action certification. Well, as of a week or so ago, or maybe a little bit longer than that, more than 175 trial court decisions have been rendered on motions to dismiss, with the insurers obtaining dismissals with prejudice in about 106 of those cases, dismissals without prejudice in 34 of those cases, and policyholders were able to avoid dismissal in 29 cases. And there have been some rulings on summary judgment, with insurers winning about 7 and policyholders 5. So these cases continue to be filed, maybe pace of which is slowing down a little bit, but we have not yet had one appellate court ruling on the merits of coverage for COVID-19. So with that by way of background, Jeff, what's your take on the COVID-19 coverage litigation to date, and what are the trends that you're seeing?
So it's definitely been the biggest and most widespread issue to face insurers and policyholders, I think pretty indisputably ever. Other events that spawned tons of claims from the 9/11 terrorist attacks to Hurricane Katrina to more recent storms like Sandy and Irma. Those were all fairly localized to maybe one, two states. But with COVID-19, it's been everywhere. I mean, as you noted, we've had, 1,500 plus cases, and the decisions have been pretty much as varied as one might expect with that kind of volume. But a few trends have definitely emerged. In the carrier's favor, a lot of cases have gone their way, usually on one of two grounds, the first of which coming down to five simple words that turned out to not be so simple, to direct physical loss or damage. And generally, I think there's been at least 100 plus courts that have ruled an insurer's favor on that issue. And they found that under the business income and extra expense provisions of these property policies, the COVID-19 pandemic has not caused direct physical loss of or damage to the policyholder's premises. And they've rejected arguments by the policyholders that the loss of the ability to use the building for its intended purpose, whether that's as a dine-in restaurant or a retail store, courts have found that the loss of use in those cases does not satisfy that requirement. And then the second major area where insurance companies have been winning a lot of cases has been the virus exclusion, which there's several variations of, but in general, courts that have dismissed these cases have read virus exclusions as barring coverage for any loss that involves an exclusion or involves a virus in any form. So typically courts that have applied virus exclusions have rejected arguments about concurrent causation or the virus just being one in a series of causes of the policyholder's loss. And then on the other side, you've had a handful of cases, I think a little over 20 now, that in which the policyholder has survived a motion to dismiss. And by and large, in those cases, courts have found that at least at the motion to dismiss stage, the policyholder presented enough fair facts about the circumstances of their loss to show that they may have suffered something that will equate to direct physical loss of or damage to the premises. And then, so that's the second category in terms of overall trends. And then the third, which is the smallest, is a small subset of cases, I think only four to date, where policyholders have actually won coverage on summary judgment motions of courts finding outright that their losses due to the pandemic shutdown orders do trigger coverage. And I believe in at least half of those cases, appeals are currently pending. So you've got in the early running, those three main categories of trends, and the insurance companies have won a lot of victories on motion to dismiss, and it remains to be seen how the appeals in those cases play out, and then on the other side, how the trials on coverage in the cases in which motions to dismiss have been denied proceed, and then on the cases where policyholders have won summary judgment, it'll be interesting to see how appeals courts handle those as well.
And what's really interesting, of course, even those policyholders that survive motions to dismiss, there are several other coverage issues presented in many of these cases relating to timing, And you know, what, if any, covered damages there would be, period of restoration, those sorts of issues. But I'm with you. I think that the COVID coverage wars are just beginning. Until we start seeing some appellate court decisions, the policyholders will be vigorously pursuing, they're refining their theories and arguments in response to court decisions. They're looking for hospitable jurisdictions. We're learning at the trial court level some spots where they're faring better than others. But until we get appellate court rulings, it's far too early to proclaim the insurers victorious in the COVID coverage battles. And of course, now we're just talking with about business interruption under first party policies, but we are going to be seeing professional liability, D&O, workers' comp, general liability claims. So a lot more ground to cover in the COVID coverage wars. But Jeff, this is also an area where we have to not just pay attention to the court decisions, but also federal legislation, most of which that's been proposed seems to be prospective in nature, but also state proposed legislation, some of which would vitiate virus exclusions, dilute or eliminate the requirement of physical loss. And of course, most recently, the state of Washington has chimed in with some proposed legislation. So that's another area we have to look for and keep our eyes out for when we're talking about coverage for COVID claims, correct?
Yeah, that's right. And it'll be interesting to see with the Washington proposal if that gains traction. I know several states last year came up with, some lawmakers came up with proposals to impose a retroactive obligation on property insurers to cover business interruption claims attributed to the pandemic. And as far as I know, I don't think any of them have gained traction yet. And there's also the similar proposal in Congress that I, again, don't believe has gained traction.
And so I'm sure we'll be back later in the year to talk, give people an update on the COVID, the coverage wars relating to COVID. But let's start talking about some of the individual cases that you've identified as being significant decisions from 2020. And the first one is the California Supreme Court's decision back in April in the Montrose case, a case that's yielded several rulings over many years. But why don't you give us some brief background on the issues in that case and the court's ruling as it pertains to exhaustion?
Sure. So the Montrose decision, in most normal years, it probably would have topped the list of the most important decisions. 2020 was not a normal year by any means. And so headlines were dominated by the COVID coverage litigation. But yeah, so in Montrose, which still proved to be a very important decision that's already had some implications in California and beyond. The California Supreme Court decided in essence that Montrose Chemical Corporation was not obligated to plead all of its lower level insurance policies before being able to tap into excess policies to cover environmental damage claims dating back three decades. And so the state Supreme Court issued a decision that reversed a state appeals court's ruling and found that terms found in a lot of Montrose's excess insurance policies over a span of decades mandate vertical rather than horizontal exhaustion. And basically what that means is that for practical purposes, if Montrose had been required to horizontally exhaust all the lower level policies, which in this case covered periods spanning 1961 to 1985. In Montrose, the California Supreme Court reversed a state appeals court's ruling And what the appeals court had found was that a lot of Montrose's excess policies over a period spanning from 1961 to 1985 mandated horizontal exhaustion, which would have required Montrose to exhaust the limits of all of its lower level insurance before it could reach excess coverage in any year. But the California Supreme Court disagreed with that analysis and instead applied the competing vertical exhaustion method, which for practical purposes is going to allow Montrose to select any policy that was excess policy that was triggered to cover its losses due to these environmental damages claims, provided that the underlying policies within the same tower of coverage for that same year had been exhausted. And that was a big decision because of the practical implications. In essence, it puts the burden on the insurance companies to work out contribution and who owes what once the policyholder has been able to select any of its triggered policies. So it's a decision that has already been cited in some other California appellate court cases. And because of California's influence across the country, it's probably going to be cited in other exhaustion disputes in other states.
And what's interesting is I would say that the decision was incorrect, but not surprising, because we'd seen the California Supreme Court already rule in favor of an all sums or joint several allocation approach. And, most courts that go that way, one of the other names for that type of allocation is also a vertical exhaustion. And so they may not necessarily go together, but most joint and several all sums rulings in those jurisdictions do provide for vertical exhaustion. But it is disappointing in the sense that the court made a big deal about saying that policy language could alter the result. And it set out in detail what some of the provisions, other insurance, exhaustion language in the policies provided. But then in its decision really passed over all the language and really didn't discuss the particular language. So in that sense, it's disappointing. And the door is still left open for insurers to argue based on their policy language that horizontal exhaustion is required. But that one goes clearly in the bucket of vertical exhaustion being permitted. Next up, Jeff, is the Ninth Circuit September 2020 decision in Access Reinsurance versus Northrop. And basically that decision tells us something else about the ability of an excess carrier to challenge exhaustion of the underlying insurance, correct?
Yeah, that's right. And in this case, a short summary is that the Ninth Circuit said that in most cases, unless—
We don't like, Jeff, on this show, we don't like the use of the word short. because some of us still are hoping for a growth spurt, but go ahead.
Yeah, so I'll be sure to avoid using the word short in the future. But back to the case, by way of a brief summary, the Ninth Circuit basically said that unless an excess policy's terms provide the ability for the carrier to challenge the decisions made by the lower level insurance companies in the same tower, it's by and large isn't going to be permitted to do so. And in this case, the policyholder, Northrop Grumman Corporation, had paid a settlement of a Department of Labor investigation into its alleged violations of ERISA. And the Northrop's two lower level insurers, National Union and CNA, agreed to fund that settlement And then fast forward a few years, and Northrop was looking to fund another settlement of a proposed class action alleging ERISA violations. And because the prior DOL settlement had led the two lower level carriers to exhaust their coverage, the burden then fell on a second level excess carrier, AXIS Reinsurance. And what AXIS tried to argue was that because they took the stance that the DOL investigation and the allegations involved there didn't trigger the coverage under the lower level insurance, and as a result, they should not be required to pay the subsequent settlement of the class action case. And that's a theory that took on the title of improper exhaustion or improper erosion. And a California federal judge agreed with AXIS and allowed it to recover a portion of its payment towards the class action settlement. But then the Ninth Circuit took a second look at that and said that the district court had gotten it wrong and adopted a general rule that I alluded to, that an excess insurer generally won't be entitled to challenge any lower level insurer's payment decisions, to argue its coverage hasn't been reached unless there are explicit terms in the excess policy that allow it to do so. So again, just like the Montrose case, this is an influential decision issued under California law. I've already seen it cited in a couple of similar insurer versus insurer cases, where the excess insurers are trying to advance the improper erosion theory. So I think it's going to continue to have implications for throughout 2021 and beyond.
Well, I do think we're going to see the case cited whenever somebody's fighting against the challenge to exhaustion. But certainly this is not the first word nor the last word on exhaustion. And the court basically said in this case that an excess insurer has to show fraud or bad faith in order to challenge a primary insurer's other settlements, which would be valid basis, I agree, but far from the only basis to challenge exhaustion. Case a little bit unusual in that there was a valid concern about unscrambling an egg after the fact, but really insurers, excess insurers, I think in a lot of cases have a lot more latitude to challenge exhaustion, keeping in mind that policyholders have the fundamental duty to prove up their case and to prove that what was properly or improperly exhausted. And even the Ninth Circuit in a prior case, the Shy case, provided excess insurers with greater latitude to challenge exhaustion and basically pointed out that foul form excess insurers are bound by the policy language in the primary policies, but not by the primary insurer's interpretation of that language. So again, one of many exhaustion cases, I think somewhat unique facts, but nonetheless, an important decision, as you say, under California law. So let's move a little bit east to the Delaware Supreme Court decision back in October of 2020 in the In Re Solera insurance coverage appeals. Give us a take on what that's all about and why that decision by the Delaware Supreme Court in your mind is significant.
So this decision made a lot of waves because of the number of corporations who were incorporated in Delaware. And it resolved, at least under Delaware law, this issue of whether directors and officers, insurers, can be called upon to cover companies' costs in appraisal or similar proceedings. And the Delaware Supreme Court said that for appraisal proceedings brought under the state's corporate law, that those proceedings do not trigger D&O coverage. And in so doing, they put an end to Solera Holdings' bid to have its costs in an appraisal case challenging its buyout by Vista Equity Partners. And basically what the Delaware Supreme Court said in focusing on this question of what is a securities claim, they found that the nature of an appraisal action places it outside of what can be considered a securities claim under a D&O policy. And for anyone who's not familiar, that term is usually defined as some variation on an actual or alleged violation of any federal, state, or local statute, regulation, or rule, or common law regulating securities. And so the Delaware Supreme Court looked at the history and intent of Delaware's appraisal action scheme and said it doesn't fit that definition of a securities claim because appraisals are what they described as neutral proceedings that serve only to determine the value of shares held by stockholders who object to a merger. And in the words of Justice Karen L. Valhura, as she said, because appraisal actions involve no adjudication of wrongdoing, they do not involve violations of any law or rule, and thus they do not fall within the definition of a securities claim. And so this had been an issue that had been widely litigated in a number of D&O disputes brought in different courts and involving Delaware corporations, and the Delaware Supreme Court put an end to policyholders' attempts to secure coverage for costs related to appraisals.
And this really is a significant win for D&O insurers because the Delaware Supreme Court really carries a lot of significant weight when we're dealing with issues like this, because so many companies traditionally have been incorporated under Delaware law, and Delaware is the home of many appraisal actions. So it's a big win. I did want to, if I could, Jeff, even the scorecard a little bit, because we talked about a couple of policyholder wins in the allocation exhaustion front. So I wanted to briefly mention the Rosello decision from the Maryland Supreme Court in 2020. The Rosello decision was significant because it confirmed what we already thought, which was since the 1999 decision of the Maryland High Court in Bausch and Lomb, that Maryland is a pro rata allocation jurisdiction. This decision makes that very clear and shows that the court fully appreciates the folly of reading the all sums language in isolation from the during the policy period limitation in GL policy forms. And the court really recognized that pro rata allocation is the majority and the better reasoned approach based on the policy language, based on maintaining consistency between trigger and allocation theories, based on fairness and judicial economy. So the insurers can put Maryland squarely in the pro rata allocation group. Now, Jeff, we had to, or wanted to bend the timeline a little bit to get beyond 2020 and into January 2021, because of a very significant decision by the Florida Supreme Court in the Citizens Property Insurance versus Manor House case. And this is a case that had been widely followed by both policyholders and insurers. Why don't you give us your insights on that case and the significance of it?
Sure. So yeah, this was a really significant decision out of the Florida Supreme Court. And they found that policyholders who are engaged in property insurance disputes can't recover what are known as consequential damages in pure breach of contract actions. And consequential damages can include anything that, as many have characterized it, anything that flows from an insurance company's breach of their coverage obligations. And in this case, it was lost rent suffered by the owners of apartment complexes. Can also include appraiser fees and the like. And in this case, you had the state-backed Citizens Insurance Corporation involved in the dispute with its insured, which was, as I noted, the owner of the apartment complexes. And a lower appeals court decided that the apartment complexes should be allowed to at least make a case for recovering consequential damages in the form of lost rent. And Citizens, which you all might remember, was found to be immune to statutory bad faith claims in the case of Perdido's son several years ago, argued that allowing consequential damages in a breach of contract case like this would basically be the equivalent of permitting the insured to pursue bad faith damages just under another guise. And so the Florida Supreme Court here reversed the Intermediate Appeals Court and agreed with Citizens that the policyholder's claim was actually one for extra-contractual bad faith damages based on Citizens' alleged failure to timely adjust the insured's loss. And it's significant because even though this case involved Citizens, which has already been held to be immune to bad faith claims, I think that the implications stretch beyond that to private insurance carriers in Florida as well, because of the broad wording of the Florida Supreme Court's opinion. They said that we conclude that extra contractual consequential damages are not available in a first party breach of insurance contract action because the contractual amount due to the insured is the amount owed pursuant to the express terms and conditions of the insurance policy. And so in saying that, they basically were signaling that if certain costs, certain damages payments are not contemplated in the coverage of the policy, they can't be recovered in a simple breach of contract action. So the decision leaves open the door for policyholders to still upon prevailing in breach of contract suit against a private insurance carrier, then pursuing a first party bad faith action against that carrier. But it closed the door on what Citizens had deemed to be kind of an end run around the bad faith immunity that it had obtained.
And really, in that case, the loss of rent income was significant, and the policyholder, as you say, could not have pursued a bad faith claim against Citizens because of its statutory immunity. But policyholders and their lawyers were salivating across the board with the appellate court decision because their hope was if that decision was allowed to stand, that they could assert consequential damage claims from a coverage action, a breach of contract action without filing a bad faith claim. And that had several ramifications that they found to be to their advantage. For one thing, under Florida law, to assert a bad faith claim, you have to give a notice which provides specificity and they would be able to circumvent that. For a second thing, insurers are afforded a 60-day opportunity to pay or cure to avoid bad faith damages. And really a contrary ruling by the Florida Supreme Court might have opened Pandora's box because not only would policyholders seek to increase the scope of discovery in a breach of contract case, it would provide an avenue for them to avoid having the bad faith claim stayed or dismissed unless or until coverage is found, which is generally what happens in Florida. You don't proceed with a bad faith claim unless it would prevail on the coverage claim. So very important victory for the insurer there beyond, and not just for those that are statutorily immune from bad faith claims. So another case came down, this one from the Connecticut Supreme Court, Nash Street, and it dealt with the duty to defend. It's interesting because usually when you're dealing with duty to defend cases, you're talking about there being a potential for coverage because of factual uncertainty. This decision dealt with a potential for coverage and therefore a duty to defend because of legal uncertainty. Why don't you give us some details on that case?
Sure. So this is a case that involved a dispute between an insurance company and a general contractor for a legal judgment that was the result of the collapse of a home during renovations. And so here, so the Connecticut's Supreme Court said that the a trial court had wrongly determined that the insurance company called Main Street Assurance was not obligated to pay for a this $558,000 judgment against the general contractor. Finding, they said that the insured had demonstrated the possibility of coverage. And so this was noteworthy because it was the first time that any Connecticut appellate court had been called upon to interpret these so-called business risk exclusions that generally bar coverage for damage to, quote, that particular part of a property on which the policy order its subcontractors have been working. And you've seen a split in authority on this. Some state and federal courts have narrowly construed that phrase to refer to a specific piece of a property, while others have interpreted it more broadly to include an entire construction project. And so here, the insurance company said that in the case against the general contractor, these exclusions bar coverage for all the damages to the house that collapsed because that particular part, there's that three-word phrase again, of this property on which the insured was performing operations was the whole house. Because the entire house had been lifted prior to renovations. But the Connecticut Supreme Court disagreed with that analysis, said the exclusions didn't relieve the insurance company of defending or paying the judgment. And the Supreme Court said there was a possibility of coverage, which is the standard for the duty to defend, because the exclusions precluded coverage only for defective work to the house's foundation, not to the whole house or the interior renovations. And so in conclusion, so the Supreme Court said that at the time the insurance company received a request for defense in the underlying action, there was a possibility based on the allegations in the complaint that the damages were covered by the policy. And they said that this possibility existed because of legal uncertainty as to the meaning and application of the exclusions. So it was an interesting approach where the Connecticut Supreme Court said that because there was this split in authority on the interpretation of the business risk exclusions, the insurance company could not argue that coverage for this case against its insured was definitively excluded.
Yeah, and a troubling case, is, as I mentioned, because not a lot of cases finding a duty to defend based on legal uncertainty. I think, in fact, less cases than what one might garner from looking at the Connecticut Supreme Court's opinion. Certainly Washington, the state of Washington had gone that way, but you know, it raises a lot of issues. Is the doctrine limited to exclusions? How factually similar must appellate level authority be to be considered or to create legal uncertainty? What about the lack of controlling authority where the terms of the exclusions appear to plainly apply? Or the lack of appellate authority alone should not create legal uncertainty. And also, why should an insurer be held hostage when there's no controlling authority in a jurisdiction to the lowest common denominator of states, one or two decisions in other states? So it's a troubling decision. The Connecticut's Supreme Court's answer or recommendation to insurers was, in those circumstances, defend under an ROR and file a declaratory judgment action where a legal uncertainty may exist. So we haven't heard the last on this issue, but it's a decision insurers should pay heed to. So we have about 3 or 4 minutes left, Jeff, and about 3 cases to watch in 2020. So I'm going to put a time limit on you to about a minute for each of the cases, if you can, to sort of highlight for us what the issue is that the court is expected to decide. The first is G&G Oil of Indiana versus Continental Western Insurance Company before the Indiana Supreme Court.
I'll try to keep it a little briefer. I tend to go long on the details. This case,
cases, we're going to get you back after the decisions come down.
Yeah. I'll definitely be the victim of karma here. The first case that you mentioned, G&G Oil versus Continental Western Insurance Company, it involves a novel question that's only been ruled upon a handful of times around the country and never by a state Supreme Court. And that's the question of whether a ransomware attack can trigger coverage under a crime insurance policy. And so this case is pending before the Indiana Supreme Court, which will become the first state high court to weigh in. And they're reviewing a mid-level appeals court's decision that this oil company is not entitled to coverage for Bitcoin ransom payments it made. And so the Indiana Supreme Court's ultimate decision here, since it'll be the first from a state high court, is expected to have a lot of influence around the country, and especially with the proliferation of ransomware attacks. I think that's going to be an issue that comes to the even more to the forefront in coverage litigation in the years to come.
Absolutely. Closely watched case for sure. The second case you pointed out as one to watch is a D&O coverage battle before the Delaware Supreme Court and RSUI versus Murdoch.
A few sources have told me that this is probably the most important D&O case in at least several years, and it involves a number of interlocking issues in Dole Food Company and several executives bid for a coverage of $222 million in settlements of a pair of suits brought by shareholders. And probably the biggest issue here deals with the choice of law. And here, the trial court found that Delaware law, which is viewed as more favorable to policyholders on a number of issues, applied to the case because Dole was incorporated in Delaware. And the underlying stockholder suits were filed there. One of the excess insurers for Dole took exception to that and said that California law should apply to the case because Dole is headquartered there, and its D&O policies were negotiated and delivered there. And in this case, the distinction matters because California has an explicit law on the books that bars coverage for fraudulent conduct, which according to Dole's excess insurer would bar coverage for Dole and its CEO's settlements in these cases. Delaware, meanwhile, doesn't have any prohibition, at least a clear prohibition on such coverage. So the Delaware Supreme Court will have an opportunity to decide whether the fact that a company is incorporated in Delaware should be given a lot of weight and weigh in favor of Delaware law applying to D&O coverage disputes. And then it'll also be able to decide for the first time whether there is any coverage afforded for allegations of fraud in D&O policies under Delaware law.
Which way do you think it's going to come out? I'm going to put you on the spot.
It's tough to say. I honestly couldn't even guess. I try not to make too many prognostications, lest they backfire on me.
Well, you just have been listening to me over the years and see how wrong somebody could be. The final case that you spotted is one to watch is Ader International versus Star. That's before the Ninth Circuit. What's the issue there?
So in this case, so you have a dispute between the insured, Deere International LLC, which owns, and I'm going to try my best here, I think it's the Curacao line of department stores in California. And so you've got them on one side, you've got their insurance company, Star Indemnity and Liability Company, on the other. And the question is, does California law that bars insurance coverage for false advertising and unfair competition claims, is it valid and enforceable, or does it violate insureds' constitutional rights to defend themselves against legal claims? And so this case is potentially make a lot of waves because of the constitutional questions involved. You've got the statute that prohibits insurers from providing coverage for an entire class of claims brought by the state's attorney general for false advertising and unfair competition. And you've had a number of amicus briefs filed. The AG of California has weighed in and said that there are no constitutional issues raised here because there's no constitutional right for companies to have their insurer pay for their defense of a claim. And he's also noted that the policyholder here, which is a giant corporation, has been able to fund its own defense. But then on the other side, you have Deere and United policyholders saying that laws like the one at issue here interfere with individuals and companies' abilities to defend themselves against accusations of wrongdoing. And United policyholders have said that, in addition, companies like Deere, these sophisticated corporations are one thing, but the implications are more dire for individuals who, without insurance, could not mount any sort of defense against these types of claims. So it's a case that I think will make waves in California, and hopefully we'll have an answer for that one and these two others within a couple months.
Well, fortunately for both of us, the beat goes on with important decisions pending and being decided. And we'll have you back in the summer to recap sort of mid-year what significant decisions have come down, including these three and other cases out there. And for our viewers, everybody can stay up to date by following your reports in Law 360. And ladies and gentlemen, we thank you very much for joining us. We look forward to bringing another episode of Insurance Law Television to you soon. And as always, if you have any ideas for topics or guests, please let us know. And thank you for tuning in.
You've been watching Insurance Law Television. For information on past and upcoming Insurance Law Television and Insurance Law Radio programs, visit the Insurance Services Practice Group page of www.hinshawlaw.com and click on Multimedia. This is Royal Oaks thanking you for joining us and inviting you to join us for the next episode of Insurance Law Television.